supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia's police union wins a small battle, part of a larger fight to end the city's practice of releasing names of police officers involved in shootings. More from WHYY's Dana DeFilippo.
Philly's Fraternal Order of Police has been fighting, without success for years, the city's policy of identifying officers who shoot people.
They don't get no peace!
Then last Thursday, a small group of Black Lives Matter activists descended on the house of an officer who shot a man in the back in June. They hung wanted posters on telephone poles with Officer Ryan Pownall's picture. They called him a murderer and shouted for justice for David Jones, the man Pownall shot to death during a traffic stop in North Philly. Activists in other parts of the country have taken their protests to the front lawns and sidewalks of cops accused of brutality, but it was the first time it's happened here. And the police union hopes it will be the last. At an emergency hearing Friday, the FOP challenged the city's release of officers' names. City officials agreed to wait 3 days after a police-involved shooting to identify the officer. FOP President John McNesby says it's an issue of safety.
You can't put your law and order people in jeopardy. All right, let the investigation take its course and let's see where it leads before you go out there and you start releasing people's names for transparency.
But civil rights attorney David Radovsky, a police reformer, says releasing officers' names has not endangered them.
There have been hundreds and hundreds of police-involved shootings over the years. There is simply no history in Philadelphia of any officer being intimidated or assaulted or any other kind of criminal action against an officer simply because that officer's name was released.
It's also a matter of transparency, says attorney Paul Hetznecker, another police reformer.
Police officers are public officers. They serve in a public forum, and their conduct is evaluated publicly.
Hetznecker points out that the internet has helped expose credibility problems with some officers. Videos of police brutality often conflict with what officers say happened.
If misconduct has been committed, the first step in accountability is releasing the information, including the names of the officers directly involved.
The FOP and the city will face off in court during a full hearing on the issue on September 29th. Until then, both sides are drumming up support. The union is hosting a Back the Blue rally this Thursday night outside its headquarters in the far northeast. And Black Lives Matter activists say they have additional actions planned this week as well. Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
Delaware Governor John Carney signs an executive order today forming a group to study developing offshore wind technology. WHYY's Zoe Reed has more on the effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and create jobs.
The Offshore Wind Working Group will evaluate the environmental and economic development benefits of offshore wind and consider the costs and logistics of construction. This is not the first time the state has attempted to develop offshore wind technology. Several years ago, NRG Energy called off plans to develop the renewable energy source due to what it called monumental challenges. Carney says conditions are more favorable today.
We've been down this road before and were unsuccessful in getting a project off the coast of Sussex County off the ground, but I think conditions have changed significantly, and I think we'll hear from folks about that. But this working group is going to be established to investigate those conditions, to look at new technologies, to look at the effect on electricity rates in our state, to see if there's an opportunity for Delaware to finally go down that path and get some offshore wind generation going.
Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control Secretary Sean Garvin says it's critical the state, nation, and world take advantage of renewable sources and move away from fossil fuels.
Delaware is the lowest-lying state in the nation. We are already feeling the impacts of climate change from Wilmington to Cape Henlopen to Seaford to Merrydale. We recognize that if we don't do something to address fossil fuel consumption, 11% of this state will be inundated by water by the end of the century.
The working group will report to the governor by December 15th with recommendations for offshore wind development. From the Delaware Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
With Tropical Storm Harvey continuing to wreak havoc in Texas and Louisiana, Let's learn more with Raymond Kruslow, Senior Service Hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Mount Holly, New Jersey. Ray, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Oh, you're welcome, Dave.
We're hearing terms like storm of the century. This one's been described as one in 500 years. What makes this storm so unique?
Well, when you talk about tropical storms, there's many facets to deal with. But I think in this particular case, we're talking about the catastrophic rainfall that is taking place as we speak.
It's the rain more so than the wind?
At the moment, it is. It did make landfall as a major hurricane, so there was some impacts in terms of wind right along the coast. The system pretty much weakened as soon as it moved inland, and now it's just basically more of a very significant rainstorm.
Are you familiar with a rainstorm of this intensity and duration in the United States in your time studying the phenomenon?
Yes, you don't have to go too far back, and we're looking at a very similar, almost the exact same geographical area. Tropical Storm Allison, which occurred back in 2001, was a benchmark for rainfall in tropical systems, not only in the state of Texas, but for the country. And Houston, back at that point in time, received about 35 inches of rain.
Tell us more about this specific storm at this juncture. Do we know its duration before it finally moves off of the afflicted areas?
Right now, the center of the storm is, and it's still classified as a tropical storm as we speak. It's right along the coast, south of Houston, and it's going to meander back into the Gulf of Mexico for a short time, and then for the next, let's say, 24 hours or so, come Wednesday, it'll move back inland. And right now, the forecast in the 3 to 5 day range takes it into the Mississippi Valley. It found what we call a weakness in upper level winds, where there wasn't much of a steering current. So when it made its landfall, there was nothing to move it along. So it just kind of stayed there, and it's going to remain there the next 24 to 36 hours before it starts to get a little bit of a kick and move to the northeast.
Speaking of our northeast, are there similar variables that could create a similar meandering effect for a storm?
You know, it can, but typically up this way, we don't see the same impacts, and for a few reasons. You may have heard the term a cutoff low, low-pressure systems that cut off from the jet stream. And they do meander up across our latitude. But typically, the place of origin is more so in the polar latitudes, and they drop down across the Great Lakes, for instance, and they move over the northeast. You don't have the same moisture source. So while you could have a storm sit here across the northeast or the mid-Atlantic region, typically it's not going to carry the same amount of moisture as something that we're seeing along the Gulf Coast states right now.
Do we have a sense of what's to come in the hurricane season ahead for our region?
I think we do. And first, I want to preface by, I've actually taken some phone calls today and had to answer some questions. And if there's going to be any relationship to what we're going to see for the next month or two, is there any relationship to what's taking place on the Gulf Coast right now with Harvey? And the answer is really no. There isn't. I will say that back in early August, NOAA, the National Weather Service's parent agency, who comes out with the seasonal Atlantic Basin hurricane forecast, did up things a little bit. So our average for the Atlantic Basin, at least the last 30 years, we have a total typically of 12 named storms, 6 hurricanes, and 3 at a major category. The forecast right now calls for anywhere between 14 and 19 storms across the Atlantic Basin, with 5 to 9 hurricanes, and 2 to 5 of them being major hurricanes. So they did up things a little bit in their last seasonal forecast that came out the first week of August.
Raymond Kruslow, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
You're welcome, Dave.
Ray Kruslow, Senior Service Hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Mount Holly, New Jersey. The upcoming New Jersey gubernatorial debates will likely pit Democrat Phil Murphy against Republican Kim Guadagno, though there are other parties still trying to raise enough money to qualify for the debate stage. WHYY's Ang Santos spoke with the four additional candidates running to be the Garden State's next governor.
A magic number of sorts for New Jersey candidates running for governor is 430,000. Raising that much money is the only way their message will get the exposure brought along with televised debates. An uphill climb for third-party candidates fighting for name recognition.
The thing that most disappoints me is that the polls don't include me by name. The polls are all about the Democrat and the Republican, and then they kind of have some sort of mini statement about independence, and they don't give us our own name. Everyone who's on the ballot in November should be in a poll, and the people of New Jersey should be asked where they stand in terms of all of us.
Green Party candidate for governor Seth Copperdale is the pastor of Reformed Church in Highland Park. Outside of days of worship, he finds himself on city streets telling people why they should vote for him.
We need an administrator who builds people up. We need an administrator who listens to the people, an administrator who works with everyone and believes that everybody has an opportunity to contribute to a better New Jersey.
A different type of campaigning is held at a gun range in Randolph. Libertarian candidate for governor Peter Rohrman speaks out against New Jersey's strict gun carry laws.
In New Jersey, we have plenty of cases where people are going to jail for just mere possession of a firearm, traveling back and forth to the range. I personally know of a man who was incarcerated for years because he was in the middle of a move. And during this move, he deviated from the course just slightly. And because of that, he was sentenced to 7 years in jail. Luckily, he got out early, but there are plenty of victims when it comes to New Jersey's firearms laws.
Rohrman is a former Marine who's now a youth athletics coach and network engineer by trade. The Libertarian has his own plans to overhaul hot-button issues in Trenton like property tax and the school funding formula.
I am shooting to get on that debate stage. If you put me up there with Kim and Phil, my policies will put them to shame. And the people will be able to vote for me. The key to winning this election is me getting on that debate stage.
No matter what third-party candidate you speak with, they all agree that it's time for Garden State residents to realize they have more than two big party choices at the voting booth.
There's always going to be a system for the head parties. Even though they hate each other's guts, they'll agree to make sure that it's just a duopoly as opposed to having other representation. So I know for a fact it's set against, third parties and truly set against the people. I mean, if you've got a system, it's a system of fear, and fear is the greatest form of enslavement. It's a system of slavery.
Matt Riccardi is the youngest person running for governor at the minimum requirement age of 30. Riccardi is a former military veteran and political science graduate from Hofstra University. He's running under the Constitution Party platform, but ultimately thinks the governor should be chosen based on quality of candidate and policies.
Parties aren't going to save the world. As I love the Constitution Party and think they put up the best candidates and they're well vetted, I would never give a blanket statement and say that I would completely support a party, because you never know.
Which brings us to Gina Genovese, the first Democrat in Long Hill Township's history elected as mayor.
And what I found is that if you take an issue, no matter whether you're Republican or Democratic, in the Democratic Party, if you take an issue and you can work together on that issue, that's really how you make progress.
Genovese has identified as an independent for the last 8 years. She, like the other third-party candidates, believes a Murphy or Guadagno administration is more of the same.
The same lip service, the same Band-Aid approach that we have taken. I don't see any new ideas. Frankly, as we know in Jersey politics, the party, the machine, it plays a huge role. And I don't even know if I would be able to make any headway. But certainly an independent approach, why not try it? The others haven't really worked, so let's try an independent approach.
There's four third-party candidates to choose from in New Jersey's upcoming governor's election. They have until the end of August to raise enough money to qualify for televised debates. For WHYY, I'm Ang Santos in Newark.
The opportunity to monitor the largest asteroid to pass in proximity to Earth since researchers began keeping close tabs on the phenomenon. Let's look aloft with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, let's sing the praises of Florence.
An odd name, I suppose one would think, for an asteroid, but nonetheless, it is a significant one. Astronomers and researchers have been keeping tabs on near-Earth asteroids for a little while now in hopes of being able to identify those that might be a danger to us, pose some sort of danger to us in terms of collision, and also in an effort to begin to think about what we might do if we find something that is indeed on course for Earth. But nothing is on course for us that we can see for at least 100 years.
How big is Florence?
It's 2.5 miles in diameter, and that could really ruin your day.
When was there an asteroid of note that did damage to planet Earth?
The last time we had such an event that gave us some hint of the dangers of such an impact was in 2014, when a small asteroid, very small indeed, exploded over central Russia, over a city called Chelyabinsk. That one did not hit the ground at all. It was about 500 feet in size. Didn't hit the ground, but it caused extensive damage from the shockwaves, breaking windows and buildings for miles and miles and miles around. And indeed, some pieces of the Chelyabinsk meteor were found in a nearby lake. But since there was no impact damage, that was a real saving grace.
Back to Florence. How close is she getting?
Fortunately, not very close at all. About 18 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. That's a little over 4 million miles out. So there's no real danger for us in this case at all. Asteroids have passed much closer. It's just that one of this size, this is the largest one passing this close we've had in quite some time. It last passed us in 1890. This particular one will pass by Earth again, but it'll be sometime after the year 2500.
And presumably long before 2500, we'll have figured out a way to gently nudge them out of the way.
Well, hopefully we will, because between now and 2500, we also have to consider the possibility that something smaller could impact Earth. Something that's small enough to do significant damage, yet not threaten the entire planet.
The curtain is fast coming down on Cassini. What's left for the tiny but mighty research center circling Saturn?
Well, the spacecraft has been out in space now for 20 years. It's been 13 of those 20 years orbiting Saturn, picking up all kinds of information and data, relaying it back to Earth. Its original mission was only 4 years long, but the mission had been extended 3 times. And so here we are now at 2017, approaching the last orbits. In fact, the spacecraft is going to start its second-to-last orbit coming up this weekend on Sunday. It'll have another orbit after that about a week later. And then on September 15th, the spacecraft will make its final approach to Saturn and drop right down into the atmosphere where it's expected to be destroyed. On these last passes, the spacecraft will have the opportunity to dip down into the atmosphere of Saturn, just skimming inside the atmosphere. And during that last plunge, the spacecraft will continue to collect and send back data immediately after collecting it within seconds before we lose contact with the spacecraft altogether, which will be considered the end of the mission.
Pretty exciting to even consider the possibility of what kind of data might come from that final descent.
Oh, it's certain to be exciting that morning to see what we can understand about the interior of that atmosphere. It's such an incredibly dynamic place. And it's not the first time we've dropped a spacecraft into the atmosphere of a gas giant, but this is Saturn. That makes it all that much more exciting.
With clear skies, is Saturn among the planets available to be seen in the night sky this week?
It is. In fact, for the next several weeks, we can watch Saturn. Even as the spacecraft orbits on its way in, it's available in the evening sky after sunset in the south-southwestern portion of the sky, easily visible. Not as bright as Jupiter, which is low in the west just after sunset, but this is further around to the left from Jupiter, which is easy to identify.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. A federal court judge denies a conservative group's attempt to temporarily block a Pennsylvania school district's transgender bathroom policy. Details from WHYY's Sarah Hoover.
For the past year, the Boyertown Area School District has allowed students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms corresponding to their gender identity. The Alliance Defending Freedom sued the district on behalf of 4 students who say the policy invades their privacy and amounts to sexual harassment. The group wanted the policy reversed while its lawsuit moves forward. But on Friday, a federal judge ruled the group's claims have no merit. Lawyers for the school district say they're pleased with the ruling, while those on the other side are standing firm. Jeremy Samick, one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs, say children deserve to be protected.
I think that beliefs about gender shouldn't be a license to violate privacy inside boys and girls' locker rooms and restrooms, because that really defeats the very purpose of sex-separated facilities in the first place.
Samick says the judge's ruling won't change his argument. He says, for example, a student who was born female but identifies as male should use the girls' locker room.
Our clients are completely comfortable with sharing a locker room with somebody who's the same sex as them, regardless of whether they're transgender or not.
Now, the plaintiffs have 30 days to decide whether to appeal the ruling while the case moves forward. Mary Catherine Roper is the deputy legal director for the ACLU and represents a statewide group of transgender students. Roper says the ruling is a relief.
If the judge had granted the preliminary injunction, it would have been the first court in the country to hold that students who are uncomfortable with transgender students have a right to exclude their fellow students from the facilities that match their gender identity.
She says the judge confirmed non-transgender students can't veto the terms of their fellow students' education. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.